From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump ordered more sanctions against Iran. He also named hostage negotiator Robert O'Brien as his fourth national security advisor.
And the president announced he'll attempt to revoke California's right to set auto emissions standards that are tougher than the federal government, and said he might have to stop cities like Los Angeles from destroying themselves with homelessness as he wages political war with that blue state. Let's bring in our political strategist, John Brabender, the Republican. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. And Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hello to you, Jamal.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. And let's start with California and Governor Gavin Newsom. On Trump's move to strip California of the right to set auto emission standards, states' rights, an idea that was supported by Republicans Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon. Let's listen.
I don't know what the hell has happened to the Republican Party. And by the way, where is the Republican Party right now? Where are they pushing back? Why aren't they pushing back? They believe in federalism. They believe in state rights. At least they assert that. And they're nowhere to be found on this.
John, put aside, many auto manufacturers want these standards. Are states' rights no longer a part of the Republican Party's platform?
Well, I think you have to look at this in a little bit different context, that we're actually in campaign season. And the president has a lot of reasons to go to California, first to raise money because there's a lot of good donors there, but second of all, to take on California because California is seen iconic as ground zero for how far left the Democrat Party has come. And the intended target are those Rust Belt state sons and daughters of Reagan Democrats who see California as outside the mainstream America and see them having policies that are anti-trade, anti-helping manufacturing in this country. And it gives the president somebody to stand up and fight for. And
wait,
I think it's an effective
campaign message. Emissions. We're in the middle of a climate crisis. Emissions are serious business. Are you saying, well, it's political, so it's okay?
No, I'm saying that's what the president is saying.
Okay.
You know, what I'm saying is I think he strongly believes that a lot of times regulations get hijacked. People take a concern. Climate change is a huge concern. We should all have that concern. But I think there's a belief that the left takes what is a big concern of some type and hijack it for their policies that oftentimes are seen as extreme. And,
okay,
and
John,
I believe that's I think that's a middle America belief that that's what California does, quite frankly.
Well, John, both John and Jamal, there's also this other issue that's happening in California, and it's around homelessness. The Trump administration is threatening to take unilateral action against California. They say they want to demolish tent camps because Trump thinks it hurts the prestige of properties in cities like Los Angeles. Jamal, let's start with you. What do you think Trump is trying to do?
Well, I think Trump is trying to do exactly what John said, which is to use progressive policies that are coming out of California as a wedge to go after voters in other parts of the country. The reality is, though, that California tends to take voters or be where voters are in their hearts. For instance, you know, California led on marriage equality, and now marriage equality is one of the least political issues that it is in the country. When you talk about climate change, one of the reasons the companies are in favor of what they're doing, of what California is doing, is because they want to have a unified standard. And they know if California and these states establish a standard, they'll all meet it. And you know what? That means that new people who are entering into the market maybe won't be able to meet the standard that some of the big companies are able to do. And then they set that standard around the world. California has been very good because it's such a large market at putting these policies in place that you really can't get done in Washington because the lobbyists and the establishment is standing in the way of any kind of change. And mostly that's coming out of the Republicans. So it's amazing that the Republicans are using this opportunity to stand in way of states' rights when those states' rights are going to make the country a better place.
Now, John, I just want to ask you what the president actually said is he's hearing from investors, mainly foreigners, who move to these prestige cities like LA and San Francisco and find that there are homeless people sleeping in their expensive doorways. As a strategist, is that a look? I mean, you know, yes, he may be appealing to his base, but it sounds, you know, pre-French Revolution, those nasty homeless people.
I think more what the president is trying to do is make this a referendum on, do we want America in the future to look more like California Do we want it to look more like the opinions and the ideology of Hollywood and the liberals in California? Mm-hmm. And let's make that the referendum, because that sure seems to be where the Democrats want to take it. And I think that's a fight Republicans are more than happy to have with the other 49 states.
Yeah.
You know, John may unintentionally here be putting his finger right on the nub of what's happening here, which is that America is afraid that the rest of the country is going to look like California, which is a more diverse place. It's younger. It's got people who are concerned about science and are trying to move the country forward. And I think there are a lot of people in the country who are nervous that traditional, what they think of as traditional white America, is fading, and we will be replaced. That part of the country will be replaced by a more diverse electorate that is trying to move the country in ways that traditional white America is afraid of.
Jamal, I consider you and I to be good friends, but I can't sit here and just say, look, all of a sudden now this is about diversity. There's a difference between diversity and ideology. And what I think that the Republicans feel is that the ideology of California is much different than the ethics, the morals, the direction they want to take this country, the way that they want to affect things like health care. They see California as on steroids for what is oftentimes what we believe is the worst of the Democrat Party.
Yeah, let's get to there's so much more that we need to get to.
Always.
Let's talk about
we're not out of news.
We're not out of – I know. You know, Trump campaigned in New Mexico on Monday night where he lost by 8 points in 2016. He gave a shout-out to supporter and CNN contributor Steve Cortez. Let's listen.
Who do you like more, the country or the Hispanics? He says the country. I don't know. I may have to go for the Hispanics, to be honest with you. We got a lot of Hispanics. We love our Hispanics.
Twitter was on fire about this. I want to talk a little bit not only about what he said, but New Mexico and play. Jamal.
I don't think New Mexico is really that much in play, but there are other states out there that are. There's some research from Ekis Labs, a woman named Stephanie Valencia, who came out of the Obama White House, did a 81,000 size research sample. And one of the things they found is the president actually is doing pretty well, particularly among Hispanic Latino men. In a state like Florida, he's at about 50% among Hispanics. So he sees a wedge, a place where he can tick up a little bit, just a few percentage points. The problem is that in a bunch of the other states where people are paying attention to this, whether it's Colorado or New Mexico or Iowa, where they're not – the population is so – upset with what's happening at the border. They're so upset with babies being kept in cages. There's no way, not even just Hispanics, but even suburban white women who look at this and they say, this is not the government and the country we signed up for, where we separate babies from their mothers and we put them in cages.
Well, by the way, Steve Cortez, who is Hispanic, defended the president last night. But Sean, sorry, buddy, but I got to ask, aren't Hispanics part of the country? I mean, the country or the Hispanics?
Of course they are, and they're going to be larger and larger part. In fact, if you look at – here's what's one thing people don't understand about this election. About 37-38% are going to be either millennials or Generation Z. Millennials are barely above 50% white, and Generation Z, the majority are non-white. And so the impact that this diversity is going to have, but here's what I honestly believe in, having had talks with the Trump campaign. They are very much interested in going after the Hispanic vote, just as they are actually interested in going after the African-American vote. They feel they're going to do probably double what they did in 2016. And if that happens, that's a significant shift in votes. But to be honest with you, all this comes down to two is who becomes the Democrat nominee, which none of us know at this point.
And speaking of the Democratic landscape, there was a union event in Philadelphia yesterday, and Joe Biden accused Bernie Sanders of trying to take away union-negotiated employer health care plans under the Medicare for All. And Sanders said Biden supported trade deals that were bad for workers. Who's winning when it comes to getting this union bloc in the rank and file right now? Jamal.
Well, you know, this is a fundamental question of Democratic politics because it all depends on how you view the electorate. And I would say the electorate actually is pretty diverse. And so you have one group of voters. I was out 2 days ago. I was in Detroit, where I'm from, and I went out to the line where, at the GM Poletown plant with a bunch of striking UAW workers, bought them about 3 buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken so they could eat while they were out there on the line. And I talked to some of the folks who were there. You know what? They were mostly African-American, some women, and a couple of younger white guys. Those voters are not Trump's voters. Trump's union voters are older. They're more male. They live outside of cities like Detroit, and they live in more suburban areas. And those are the people that they're going after. And I think when you talk even inside the Democratic Party, those older voters tend to like Joe Biden. The younger ones tend to like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. So there are divides out there by geography and by gender
age. I wrote an op-ed piece 2 weeks ago for the Wall Street Journal where I said, I do not believe Joe Biden will be the Democrat nominee based on my experiences. I think what is happening when we ask who is winning, if you look at both the poll numbers and everything else, Elizabeth Warren's coming up and everybody else is coming down. And I think the reason for that is I think a lot of people think Biden is outside the mainstream of the party now on the Democratic side. He's too centrist. Number two is I think they think Elizabeth Warren is much more credible as a general election candidate. Yeah. And I frankly think she's where the Democrats are going.
We'll pick up there with John Brabender.
I agree. Look at that.
John Brabender, the Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. John, Jamal, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
It's here. Downton Abbey, the film, opens this week. Lady Mary, the Earl of Grantham, his wife Cora, Maggie Smith as the Dowager Countess of Grantham, the true star, the Highclere Castle, with its 1,000 acres of grounds sculpted by the impossibly named real-life Capability Brown, and of course the staff that runs the house, all aflutter because the King and Queen of England are coming with their staff who will replace the servants of Downton Abbey for the visit.
So my maids and I will not be involved in the preparations.
You mean during the stay, you'll be the butler and...
Excuse me, I am not a butler. I am the king's page of the back stairs.
So our staff has nothing to do?
I'm sure they can be useful.
We know that won't end well. Julian Fellowes is the creator of the TV series. He wrote the screenplay for the film and won an Oscar for his screenplay for 2001's Gosford Park. Lord Fellowes, Julian, when did you realize Downton Abbey has to be a film?
I didn't believe that the film would happen because it seemed to me too complicated. All the actors had gone off in different directions. They were on Broadway, they were making series and so on. So it was only for me, really about a year after the end of the show, that the murmur wouldn't die down. And I started to think, well, if there is a film, I'd better make a few decisions about what's going to be in it.
And let's talk about why you decided what would be in it. But also, let's put this in context. There might be a couple of people who have not seen the series. It began in 1912. Electricity, phones, cars were newfangled things. Dresses were down to the ground. In the film, we're now in, I understand, 1927 or so?
27,
yep. And we have King George V with his wife Mary. Their daughter did have a home somewhere nearby, so it could happen that they might be coming out into the country.
Well, they made a tour of Yorkshire in 1912, in fact, just before. And they were both quite keen to tour the country and be visible. You know, in those very early days of filmed newsreel, on the whole, if you wanted people to see you, you had to go there.
And what else are you trying to show us in this moment about the monarchy? Because some of the characters, we won't give it away, could care less.
Well, I mean, I don't think in that sense we're telling you about the monarchy, in that the monarchy was very successful at that time and indeed in this. You know, it is one of the unifying elements as opposed to the many, many divisive elements at the moment in Britain. So we all give thanks for it. But it was important after the First War when, you know, the whole system had been shaken to its foundations. Right. And it was their job to sort of reestablish its roots and make the public see that the show was back on the road.
Well, I mentioned some of the characters are turning away from the monarchy. These are servants who are looking longingly for their own independence. But others are, I'm thinking of Mosley. I love Mosley. Cannot practically faint. He loves his king and queen so much. So talk about the power of the monarchy for those people.
Well, I think it is very powerful, but that's why I chose it, because I was looking for an event that would affect everyone there. They would all be on their toes. They might be hostile, they might be angry, but they would all be something.
And when we spoke with you a bit ago, you said that one of your concerns was making sure the beloved characters had their time, and they do, including Tom. Tom, who's the Irish widower who'd been the family chauffeur but swept a daughter off her feet. She then sadly died in childbirth. He gets a big role. What are you trying to say here? Because I did some research, and I was reminded that Northern Ireland was created just a few years early, in 1921.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, we had the Troubles, if you remember, right, in the series.
Right.
And that is part of the story in the movie, as you know.
He was one of the Catholics who were nationalists. They wanted a united Ireland, independent of Britain, pretty much as in recent history. And there were then the Unionists who were happy about the divide. But you had that storyline, and now you have him really stepping to the front in this film.
Well, there's a moment when he says to Mary, "I'm law-abiding now," or something. "That's what you lot have done to me." And in a sense, they have not changed his beliefs. They haven't. But what they have done is change his perception on how to conduct himself in society. I mean, the reason he does have a very significant role is that when I was deciding that we were going to do it, you know, I was looking at the last series and I realized that Tom Branson was the only one who wasn't, in a sense, settled at the end of the show. Mm. Everyone else was, even the long unhappy Edith had found her perfect man.
Even Edith.
Right. And I didn't want to unpick any of that.
Yeah.
But it gave me Tom Branson as someone who could have a love story, which, well, I think the film needed.
Not just a love story, but a storyline we don't want to give away, in which those prejudices against the Irish are still very apparent. Lady Mary, Michelle Dockery, there's a you know, the whiff of the women's movement through her. She's now fully taken over the day-to-day running of Downton Abbey. And here she persuades the retired butler, Mr. Carson, played by Jim Carter, to come back to the job.
"I don't want to be a nuisance, but I need your help, Carson. Barrow just isn't up to the task."
"Milady?"
"He won't clean the silver, or he won't let Andrew clean it."
"What?"
"He says the page of the thingamy will choose which pieces to use."
"I see."
"The truth is, he's in a sort of trance. Won't you help me? I feel I'm pushing a rock uphill."
"I'll be there in the morning, my lady. Don't you worry."
"You're a treasure, Carson. That's all there is to say."
She mentions Mr. Barrow. There is a gay storyline in your film. Again, I don't want to give it away. But there are hidden clubs. He finally may also have a love life. How much of this is historically true?
Oh, no, it's all true. I mean, there were gathering places. I mean, when you think, there's no reason to believe there was any smaller percentage of people were gay in 1927 than they are now. Mm-hmm. The difference being that 98% of them were forced to live a lie. And I think it's important to remind, particularly young people, that, you know, we have come a long way in this area. I mean, at the moment, all you ever hear is how terrible everything is. But there are certain things that have improved, and that is one of them. But the gathering places were not as they would be even at the end of the 50s, when it was still illegal, but it was beginning to be clear that it wouldn't be for very much longer. That wasn't true in the 20s. And if you had a gathering place, it wasn't all lined with red plush and everyone having a lovely drink at the bar. It was in a warehouse. It was in a storeroom. It was anywhere where you could set it up and move it at a moment's notice when the police found out. Mm. And I hope that comes through in the film, that it was very, very difficult, yeah, to be gay and to live a life. And I don't want us to lose touch with that, really.
Yeah, well, it's very evident. You have in the film one of the most delightful aspects of the TV series, which is dinner and repartee, and especially the barbs thrown by Maggie Smith as the Dowager Countess. In this scene, Isabel, played by Penelope Wilton, they have a love-hate cousin relationship. She's expressing doubts about the coming royal visit.
"Seems rather a waste of money."
"Oh, here we go."
"Isn't that what the monarchy's for? To brighten the lives of the nation with stateliness and glamour?"
"To quote Tennyson, kind hearts are more than coronets and simple faith than Norman blood."
"Will you have enough cliches to get you through the visit?"
"If not, I'll come to you."
Well, first of all, Julian Fellowes, how much fun is it for you to put Tennyson in your writing?
Well, you know, it's fun when you're writing for that level of player because you know that they're going to hit the spot every time and they're going to hit the target. You know, when you know they're going to Maggie and Penelope or Imelda or whatever, it is very satisfactory. And actually, one of the greatest pleasures of this latest adventure has been to sit in an enormous cinema and hear people all laughing together because, you know, when you watch it on television, you don't get that. You know, you have your wife who's seen it 16 times before and your son who's reading a book, and that's it. And suddenly there you are in the middle of people finding it funny, and I love that.
Why do you think that is, especially here in the States? I mean, we had a war, you know, we overthrew this, and such a love affair. What do you think it is?
Well, of course, if I knew that, I would do nothing but replicate its success for the rest of my life. But I think there is a fascination in looking at how our forebears lived. And one of the things I'm really pleased about, which I hope Gosford Park and Downton have contributed to, is that when I was a child, the story of these great houses was always the story of the family. And they were the rooms that were on show. You saw the drawing room and the library and the ballroom, but you never saw the kitchens. You never saw the servants' hall. You never saw any of that. And that's completely different now. Mm. And I get a lot of letters enclosing photographs of people in liveries of footmen and housemaids and so on, and ladies' maids and everything else. And they're writing about their great-grandparents, whatever, who were in service, you know, and they did this and they did that. And I think people have started to see that it's a way of life that belongs to us all.
Well, and as you say, these shows, Gosford Park, which you wrote, Downton Abbey, are honoring the people who live downstairs. We have to ask, the film's coming out at a time, and you noted it, when Britain itself is going through turmoil. Is that a part of the appeal maybe there?
It wouldn't surprise me if people like to be able to take 2 hours off Brexit for a change. You know, we all have strong opinions about it and we all have friends on both sides. And it's an unusual situation because it's a difference of opinion that doesn't run along class lines or north and south or even age. You get families divided. People are just split about it with no real pattern. And that's very tiring, you know, to be in the middle. You go to a dinner party and suddenly the subject comes up and everyone goes hatchet-faced all round the table. And this is just a rest from it.
Julian Fellowes, we know nothing about that in this country. Julian is creator of the TV series Downton Abbey, the author of the screenplay for the new film Downton Abbey. Lord Fellowes, thank you so much for talking to us.
No, thank you for having me here.
What happens when Ronald McDonald walks into a poor immigrant neighborhood in the south of France and sets off a supersized revolution? The story of how a company slogan to sell more shakes and burgers became a rallying cry for workers in France. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
California is digging in for another fight with the Trump administration, this time over cars. President Trump said today he's in the process of revoking a waiver that for decades allowed California to set its own auto emission standards. And the administration is also in the process of rolling back Obama-era rules on fuel efficiency, rules that would require automakers to build cars that average about 54 miles per gallon by 2025. For more on all of this, let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's Here and Now's transportation analyst. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So as I mentioned, President Trump tweeted this morning that he's revoking California's federal waiver on emissions in order to make cars less expensive for the consumer. Can you explain a little bit more about this waiver and Trump's reasoning for revoking it?
So this is kind of a companion, Tanya, to what you mentioned, the rollback of the broader Obama administration era rules regarding efficiency. California, yeah, also had the right to make its own rules even stricter than what the Obama administration was mandating. And there are 13 other states, by the way, that have matched California. And so you have not only those restrictions becoming, well, less strict, but they're no longer just minimums setting a bar for states. They're now also the most, these new weaker rules, the most that states can require.
Even over the Obama era rules, right? Well, California has been able to set its own standards going all the way back to the Clean Air Act of 1970. And you've mentioned how these other parts of the country have been influenced by this. The irony here is that
California is making the argument for states' rights, but the Trump administration is arguing for more federal oversight. Is this a general Trump versus California war, or are there lobbying forces at play here?
There most certainly are. And there's some interesting alliances. You mentioned that one irony, right? In this case, the Trump administration, often on the side of states' rights, saying that California shouldn't do this. They're walking a rhetorical line here with that, Tanya. They're saying, you know, in this case, because California is, as you said, so influential, and what it does ends up impacting car manufacturing everywhere, you actually have a state having essentially undue influence over federal laws. Now, of course, many people would say, well, that's fine if that results in cleaner air and less emissions. But that's the position that they're taking. You also have here automakers to some degree on the side of environmentalists. You know, they've embraced some of this innovation, and really the oil industry being the major stakeholder here that mm-hmm. stands to lose when you have lower emissions that come from less gas consumption.
Mm-hmm. So what happens next?
Well, California says it's going to fight. Governor Gavin Newsom says it'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court. You know, California's been at this a long time, as you mentioned. The first tailpipe regulations back in the 1960s, Tanya. Mm-hmm. Yeah, before people were even, you know, thinking about climate change. It was all about local air quality back then, smog in places like Los Angeles. And those rules in California became the basis often for federal laws, which have become generally stricter over the decades.
We'll be following this for sure. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Thank you, Seth.
The war, for now, just of words, continues over Iran. Today, President Trump tweeted he's asked the Treasury to increase sanctions against the country. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo landed in Saudi Arabia. And Pentagon officials said U.S. satellite images showed activity at a launch site in Iran before last week's strike against oil fields in Saudi Arabia. Iran is denying any involvement. Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthi rebels said they did it. But even if there is proof Iran did, what should happen next? Our next guest says, not the mistake of 1987. Andrew Bacevich is a retired Army colonel, a military analyst, now president of the new Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's on Skype. And Andrew, take us back to 1987, Iraq and Iran, entangled in a terrible, bloody war. The U.S., no friend of Iran after the revolution that overthrew a monarch. The U.S. thinking was, as you write in your op-ed in the New York Times, the enemy of our enemy, Iran, is our friend. Take us through what happened next because of that thinking.
Well, this is one of the many forgotten military episodes that we've been involved in recent times. I doubt if there's more than one out of 50 Americans even know that we were involved in the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 to 1988, but we were. On the side of Saddam Hussein, that war had begun when Iraq invaded Iran. Things were not going well for Iraq. Then, as today, the U.S. government perceived Iran to be a dangerous foe, and therefore the Reagan administration decided it needed to involve itself directly in that more or less stalemated war. And we did by finding an excuse to instigate a small maritime war in which we all but destroyed the Iranian Navy. So this was a victory. The consequences of that victory were that when the Iran-Iraq War ended in 1988, within like 18 months, our friend Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He now became our enemy. I think that episode deserves reflection today. Because when we think about that episode, we can realize that back then we had no friends in the Iran-Iraq War. I believe we have no friends in the dispute between Saudi Arabia and Iran today.
Of course, the U.S. embraces Saudi Arabia as its biggest friend in the region. Explain why you don't think Saudi Arabia is.
Well, I think as a statement of fact, you are correct, but it's a fact that really deserves reexamination. That is to say, why is Saudi Arabia our friend? They share absolutely none of the values that we profess. There is an abundance of evidence that over the past 25 or 30 years, Saudis, not necessarily the government, but certainly well-to-do Saudis, have been the biggest promoter of radical Islamism around the world. And the current dispute between Iran and Saudi Arabia centers on this civil war in Yemen, in which the Saudi government, I'm sorry to say, supported by the United States, decided that it needed to intervene in Yemen. It has done so recklessly and absolutely ineffectively. That is to say, they're not making any real contribution to settling the Yemen civil war. So, sir, my question is, at this point, why is it that we feel that Saudi Arabia qualifies as an ally? Why has the United States felt obliged to provide intelligence, targeting information to the Saudi Air Force? Why are they using our weapons, killing large numbers of civilians? So it may well be the case that Saudi Arabia can determine that it has interests at stake in the Yemen civil war. So let them deal with those interests. The issue here, I think, the more immediate issue is we don't.
But just devil's advocate, we have interest in Saudi Arabia, which that's oil. And so don't we have interest in Saudi Arabia being safe? Again, devil's advocate.
Well, I mean, that is the traditional argument. It's a traditional argument that had real salience, I think, back, let's say, in the 1970s. At that time, the United States was dependent upon foreign oil. Our prosperity was directly related to our capacity to tap into oil from the Persian Gulf. That's no longer the case today. And that is one of the many reasons, it seems to me, that it's time for us to reevaluate this U.S.-Saudi relationship. What is our interest in the region? Our interest is stability, bringing an end to war. And we have been engaged in any number of wars going back to the 1980s, almost all of which were initiated somehow informed by the argument that the use of U.S. military force can bring stability to the Persian Gulf. And of course, what has occurred is just the opposite of that. So my view is simply that, you know, it's time for us to stop, take stock, consider whether or not continuing to pour fuel on the fire is actually going to produce any different results than we've gotten over the past couple of decades. And quite frankly, at some point, we're going to have to rethink our assumption that Iran is the demon in this story.
Well, this comes at a time when you have the Trump administration, very close ties to Mohammed bin Salman, the leader of the country, who is generally thought to have been behind the murder of a Washington Post reporter, Khashoggi. You know, there was a nuclear deal that most analysts said Iran was abiding by. Now some are saying that this recent strike in Saudi Arabia may be a kind of, you know, we are suffering from these sanctions. The economy is crippled. You are going to suffer too, a demonstration of that. Can diplomacy really save this?
It's hard to say. What we can say, I think, is that war is not the answer. That's a cliche. But we've given war a pretty good workout over the past 20 years or so. And we have never, I think, whether we're talking about Iraq, whether we're talking about Afghanistan, whether we're talking about Libya, whether we're talking about Somalia, we have not succeeded in achieving our political objectives in any meaningful sense. So perhaps it is time to give diplomacy a chance. And I don't say that because I think that if we just sent some envoy to Tehran, that the Iranian officials would say, oh, good, we can settle our differences, this afternoon. I think that there is a need for a sustained, creative, imaginative effort. It ought to be done multilaterally. The people who are our allies in Europe wish to defuse this situation, would like to see us get back to something akin to the nuclear agreement, which was preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. It didn't solve every other problem with regard to Iranian conduct, but it was solving the core problem of whether or not they would acquire nuclear weapons. So we need to walk this back somehow. That's not going to happen as long as Mr. Trump is president. And it will only happen with great difficulty if Trump is replaced. But it seems to me the course of diplomacy, negotiation, is the path that we ought to take.
So take your thinking further. How would the U.S. not being, quote, friends with Saudi Arabia look? Would it just be not backing them in Yemen? They also buy tons of military equipment from the U.S. How would that look to you?
To my mind, the United States should take a balanced position. Yes, we should be engaged in the Persian Gulf, but we should be engaged diplomatically in an effort to persuade Saudi Arabia and Iran that their interests are better served by settling their differences peacefully than by pursuing this rivalry between the two by military means. Not for a second am I suggesting that that would somehow be easily accomplished, but I think there's a greater likelihood of success by using diplomacy than there is by continuing to go down the military path.
So not just not backing Saudi Arabia in its fight in Yemen, telling both sides to cool it.
Yes, yeah. Through sustained, serious diplomatic engagement, which, of course, means we have to talk to the Iranians, too.
Andrew Bacevich, you know him as the retired Army colonel and military analyst, now president of the new Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, which is going to be starting up in November. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a reminder, longtime analyst Andrew Bacevich served in the Vietnam War, spoke out against the war in Iraq long before his own son died in that war in 2007.
This week, we're broadcasting from the studios of KJZZ in Arizona, where reporters from the station's Fronteras desk have just finished a series tracing the journey that migrants make from their countries of origin to the United States. On Monday, we heard about migrants from Honduras who are attempting to flee their country's violence and poverty and cross the southwestern U.S. border. Today, the focus is on migrants from Central Africa. More than 400 of them sought asylum in Portland, Maine this summer, where the newcomers discovered a wealth of hospitality. Laurel Morales reports.
Renewed violence in Central Africa has thousands of people fleeing the Democratic Republic of Congo this year, among them Joseph Yakini, his wife, and three children. He says he was persecuted for his political beliefs. The Yakinis flew to Brazil, then made the brutal journey north.
Pour nous, c'était traumatisant. Pour moi, ma femme et les enfants, on m'avait frappé.
Yakini says it was a traumatizing journey for them. When they arrived in Colombia, someone beat him in front of his family and took everything they had, all that was precious to them.
C'était vraiment traumatisant pour moi et ma famille.
Without money, they had to make much of the journey by foot. In Panama, they had to walk through a rainforest where the jungle is so thick with trees it always felt like nighttime. They had to step over dead bodies, other migrants who would not make it to the U.S.
Panama aussi, c'est l'étape qui est très, très, très difficile dans la vie pour traverser.
After 5 months, the Yakinis reached the U.S.-Mexico border. A Catholic church in Texas paid for their tickets to Maine, where the family sought refuge in the city of Portland's Expo Center with hundreds of others like them. They slept on cots, wore donated clothes, and signed up to shower as a family.
Bon, à mon arrivée ici dans le territoire américain, c'était un soulagement.
Yakini says it was a relief, but he did not feel settled. He knew the asylum process could take years.
Illégal, pas de papiers, on n'était vraiment pas sûr.
As grueling as the journey was, many asylum seekers say it was worth it. Henrique Malonda, a civil rights activist, says in Africa, he feared for his life.
We saw people being killed. We saw people being kidnapped. We saw people disappear. So as we ran investigations, we were finding dead bodies, people dumped into ditches. My grandfather was one of the victims.
Central Africa has been mired in violence for decades. When war broke out in Congo 20 years ago, Khadija Ahmad got out.
Then they were burning and just killing everybody who looked like Tutsi. Even though you were Congolese, it didn't matter.
Today at Portland's Preble Street Soup Kitchen, Ahmad is known as the Vegetable Lady.
You know the TV show Chop? Mm-hmm. They got nothing on us. This is Chop.
Ahmad says they make do with whatever ingredients they get. And recently she made fombwa, a Congolese favorite, for the hundreds of Central Africans staying at the Expo Center.
The thing with leaving your country, the food will never be the same. Food is what makes you welcome. I felt that this was what I could offer them. Let them know, you are welcome here. We got you.
And it's not just Ahmad. Many people have offered whatever they could.
Farmers, they will donate goats, a whole goat. I had like at some point 3 goats sitting in the freezer.
The Expo Center could only house the asylum seekers through mid-August. Several organizations help them find homes in and around Portland where services are convenient. 40 families wound up with host families like the Rosenbergs. Lauren Rosenberg helps Maria Casima from Angola unpack her groceries.
Modest?
Lettuce.
Lettuce.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Potato.
Huh?
Potato.
Butter.
Potato.
Butter.
Yeah.
Oh.
Please.
Lauren and her husband have 3 small children and a dog, so adding a family of 3 has doubled the noise in the house. But the Rosenbergs say it's also multiplied the joy.
It's been great. I love chatting with Maria half the time. We don't know what we're saying, but lots of charades, but there's always a big hug and kiss at the end of it.
Director of Portland's emergency shelter, Sarah Ewing Merrill, says these families have no place else to go.
And we are really the end of the line. So they're coming here not just for shelter, but they're coming here to make a life when their life has fallen apart.
She says the hard part is knowing that that life in the U.S. for these refugees is on shaky ground under the current administration's asylum policies. But José Mavongo of the Angolan territory of Cabinda isn't complaining. He wears a T-shirt with an American flag and wipes tears away as he says he and his wife finally feel safe.
It's a kind of joy that, you need to see your past and compare your past to the present so then you can know what is the gratitude means.
For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales reporting from Portland, Maine.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.